Okay, folks. So we've just started the recording. I've muted everyone out, except our active participants. So let me start off. Emily, are you there? Emily? I don't hear Emily. Maybe she'll join us shortly. Kathleen or Kathy, are you there? Kathy, Kathleen?
I'm here. Kathleen, yeah.
Kathleen, hi. Welcome and thank you so much. And we have another one who chose to remain anonymous, so I can't really call out to that person.
Hello,
is that you?
Yes,
who is this? Can you give me your first name?
Yeah, my name's Josh. I mean, I can tell you I chose to be anonymous. I didn't know how it works, but yeah, I'm the third.
That's fine. Josh is more than good enough, so thank you so much, Josh, for joining, and that's great. We'll address your issue shortly, but thanks very much for joining. The first person, Emily, is not with us, so I'm just going to read the question that she sent to my office, and then I'll discuss it. It's not a clinical case as much as it's a logistical question. So she writes the following. I have a patient who I did an examination under anesthesia for a pap smear, and this is listed in my gynecological surgeries when I asked for my case list from the hospital. In other words, the way I'm interpreting this is she asked the medical records department, give me a list of any GYN cases that I've done between these dates, and they submit a case of EUA. So she asks, does this need to be included in my gynecological list? Since I did not perform any surgical procedure beyond having anesthesia. So I don't know what she means by beyond having anesthesia. Maybe, I'm speculating now, she's not with us. I'm speculating that maybe she's a laborist or someone that was in a position that was very difficult to collect GYN cases. And so she didn't really have any, except for this very unusual one, an EUA, which was done for the purposes of doing a pap smear. So that's the question. Should this case be included on the list? So if this was done in the operating room, then this candidate, Emily, has done exactly the right thing. She's gone to medical records and told them to pull up a list of every case that I've done between the start and end dates. And they pulled up an EUA. So strictly speaking, it was done in the OR. She needs to include it on her list. And furthermore, we might think, you know, it's not your typical case. It really isn't. There's no knife. There's no instruments outside of a digital exam or a speculum. One might think there's not much to discuss. And maybe that's partially correct. But a case like this can easily bring up a discussion on do you do an EUA on every patient before you start a surgical procedure? And that's a beautiful examination question. So do you do it? Why do you do it? If you don't, why not? If you do, why yes? What are the pros and cons? So it's a reasonable question, although it's not a juicy, meaty type question. But you've got to put it on. And this leads me on to one other thing. If ever you're in doubt whether or not you should put a case on or leave it off, I would 99 times out of 100 tell you, put it on, put it in the case list, include it rather than exclude it. You cannot get into any difficulties with ABOG if you give them more than they're asking for. Let's say ABOG feels that this case is not necessary to include, and I don't believe that's the case. I think if you were to ask ABOG, they'd say if you did it in the OR, you need to put it in. But let's say you didn't they didn't need you to put it in. So if you give them an extra case by putting this in, you've given them more than they're asking for. You're not trying to hide anything. You're not trying to cut short anything. But if it's the opposite, if they're expecting you to put this in and you leave it out, then you're giving them less than what they expect. And you can theoretically get into some difficulty. So when the take-home message, whenever you folks have a case like this, if there's doubt, rather include it than exclude it. And if there's still any doubt, this is a classical case. I've never been asked, in 20 years, I've never been asked this question before, which is unusual. But this would be a good example. If there still remains doubt in your mind, just send an email to ABOG and explain to them your situation and ask them, do I include it or exclude it? And they are usually very, very good. They may get, I've seen it, they respond within 10 minutes very often, certainly within 24 hours. So if there still remains any doubt, you can always email them. Don't phone them, email them. And I would say, when, as a general principle, when you have an element of doubt, rather include it than exclude it. So I hope that answers the question. Emily's is a very specific question as it relates to an EUA. But you folks listening may have the same issue in other clinical scenarios. And the principles that I've mentioned here are exactly the same. Okay. So that's that question. Let's move on. Kathleen, I've got your email in front of me. So I know what your question is, but can you just present your question to everyone listening in, and then we can talk about it?
Sure. So my question is for my case office case log. I see patients in my attending's preoperative clinic because I'm a fellow, and I know I cannot include patients that I've operated on, but I don't operate on every patient that I see in his office. Is it appropriate for me to write what surgery they underwent and just say performed by another surgeon?
So I just before I answer your direct question, I just want to make sure I understood you correctly. You said and you wrote in your email, I know I cannot include patients that I operate on.
Correct. I both have to go with my GYN.
I see. You're talking in terms of office. Sorry, you're 100% correct. I thought we were talking about GYN list, and it just didn't make sense. No, but you're quite correct. So, folks, this point that Kathleen, and I'm going to answer your question in a moment, the point that Kathleen brings up, I see in about 25% of case lists that I review. And the issue is this. You can choose which cases you want to put on your office list. You can't choose which cases to put in your OB and GYN list. So if you've done surgery on a patient, you don't have a choice. You have to put her in the GYN list. Once they're in the GYN list, there's another clause in the ABOG bulletin that says a patient can't appear twice on your case list. Now, there are a few rare exceptions that I can advise you folks on, but to all intents and purposes, a patient should not appear twice on a case list. So if the patient has to be on the GYN list, she cannot be on the office list. You have to exclude her. So the same thing holds true if you have a patient who's an obstetric patient who, let's say, needs to have, let's say she's got a teratoma, and she lands up 11 months after delivering with an adnexal mass requiring laparoscopic oophorectomy or cystectomy. That's a difficult case because it really is two separate issues. There's an OB issue and a GYN issue. And I will just tell you, in cases like this, if you did the delivery, she really has to be on the OB side. If you did the surgery, she has to be on the GYN side, but you can't mention the patient twice. So what I would do is, on the OB side, I present her as normal, as she typically was. And then in the complications column, I would write, 10 months postpartum cystectomy. And or on the GYN, or I should say, or on the GYN side, I would present her as a laparoscopic cystectomy. But then in the pre-op diagnosis side, you can say spontaneous vaginal delivery by Candida 10 months prior. But what I think is even better than that is to list the patient. And I say this knowing full well that ABOG says you shouldn't do this. But I think it's being open, honest, and it's constructive. And that is, present the patient on the OB side for the OB delivery. And then, in addition, assuming she's got a different medical record number, because otherwise the software may cause a problem for you, but then on the GYN side, present her as a GYN case only. And then under, let's say on the OB side, it's case number 17, and on the GYN side, it's case number 5. On the GYN side, you write in the complications column, same patient as OB case number 17, and vice versa on the OB side. So you show the examiner you're not trying to be devious, you're not trying to hide anything, you're being open, honest, and transparent. But these are two legitimately completely different issues. So, Kathleen, before I go on to answer your specific question, does that make sense to you? Do you have any questions about anything I've said so far?
No.
Okay, good. So your question, is it okay for me to write that they underwent surgery, but say it was performed by another surgeon? And here the answer is absolutely yes, and I encourage you to do it because you're being open, honest, and transparent. So if you didn't do the surgery, say surgery by colleague, bladder neck suspension by FPMRS or by colleague, be open and honest about what happened. Now, that being said, because the surgery was not done by you, the candidate, does not mean to say that in the exam, the examiner is going to keep his or her hands off the case and not ask you anything. They're perfectly entitled to ask you any question relating to that surgery that is appropriate for someone taking the general board exam. So if this was an REI case, they can ask you about the case, but they would ask you questions at a general board level, not at a subspecialty board level. So I think what you're asking is exactly correct, and that's exactly what you should do, and I encourage you folks to do that. Just write. You know, another typical example might be on the OB side. There's an interesting case, perhaps a cardiac patient in pregnancy, and it's not a good example because I'm going to say delivery by midwife, but this would be an assisted vaginal delivery, which probably should not be done by a midwife, so it's not a good example. But the point I'm trying to make is, in OB, if a midwife delivered the patient, write it down, delivery by midwife, it's absolutely fine. So, Kathleen, did I answer your direct question then?
Yes.
Okay. Any other questions that you've got regarding the concern that you raised?
Yes. One other question. So,
yeah, go ahead.
My program director is a urogynecologist, but I'm a MIGS fellow. So sometimes I do participate in urogynecology procedures, although I don't plan on doing these by myself. Is it appropriate to say, you know, sling placed by urogynecologist on my GYN log?
Absolutely. And I would repeat what I just said a moment ago. Absolutely, put down on paper whatever the procedure done by FPMRS. And then in the exam, in the conversation, you would say, you know, I'm a MEGS fellow, and I don't plan on doing urogynecology on my own, but I did assist in this case as a fellow. And then preempt the examiner because you know it's coming. You would say, you know, in a case like this, the issues that one has to be aware of and be concerned for are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So again, just because you say the procedure was done by someone else, it doesn't mean to say that it's off limits to you as a candidate to have to face questions like that. An exception to what I'm saying, let's say you call in a junk onc to do a nodal dissection. It would be grossly unfair for an examiner to ask you about a nodal dissection and how to do it and what are the issues and concerns and risks. It's fair for them to ask you, under what circumstances would you call in a gyn onc intra-op for a consult, and or under what circumstances would you call in a gyn onc specifically to do a nodal dissection? That's fair game. That's the kind of question that we as generalists need to know. But how to do a nodal dissection, that's really not at our level. So, Kathleen, again, does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, sure, no problem. All right, Josh, you're up next. You there, Josh?
Yes, I'm here.
Great. Again, I've got your case in front of me that you sent to the office, but for the sake of everyone listening in, go ahead and just present your case to us as briefly as you can.
Okay. Yeah. So it's a difficult case that I just want some guidance on how to like recommend defending. So, 57-year-old G1P1 who had an abnormal Pap smear with HSIL HPV positive. So I did a culp that came back as CIN3, and then subsequently did a LEAP procedure, which then showed CIN3 with extension to the margin, so positive margin. I repeated the Pap after an interval. It showed still HSIL HPV positive. She declined an excision. She was dead set on hysterectomy, just didn't want her cervix present at all, declined re-excision, declined an oncology referral. I counseled her on the risk of missing invasive disease and how that manifests.
So let me interrupt you for a second. This issue that you've just mentioned, you counseled her on the risks and benefits. That's really key in a case like this. And I want all of you to be aware, I'm going to extrapolate this issue across the board. Anytime you have a patient who declines any treatment that you've suggested as one of the options, it might be medical treatment, it might be surgical treatment, anytime she declines, you've got to be prepared to describe how you counseled her. Even if it's something as simple as a TOLAC, she declined a TOLAC. How did you counsel her? Because in answering that question, you're going to show the examiner your deeper understanding of the issue, of the clinical issue. And you want to make sure that the examiner does not think, when you're all said and done, that you're inadvertently intimidating the patient away from doing the procedure by virtue of the way you're counseling her. So I'm just interrupting you, Josh, for a second to emphasize to all of you listening in that counseling is always very important, and you've got to be able to, in essence, describe the risks, benefits, and alternatives. And especially it's important in any clinical situation that you folks may have where the patient declined anything, then it becomes really important. Okay, Josh, I interrupted you. I apologize, but carry on.
No. Okay. And then really kind of discussing her care and my concern that she would be lost to follow-up with this finding. and my inability to perform a re-excision under her consent, I decided to proceed with the hysterectomy, a TLHBSO, which then showed CIN3 with a focus of AIS, otherwise unremarkable PIS.
Okay, so this is a great case. Okay, it's really a beautiful, it's juicy, it's wonderful, it's great for the exam. Again, it's a case that you can really shine. And folks, let's look at this case from 40,000 feet. Here we have a case of a patient who did not have recommended treatment. Okay, and now we've Josh as the candidate, and many of you listening out there have cases like this. How do you handle this, Josh? For the sake of just ramping it up, I'm going to say the final histology on the hysterectomy came back benign, no CIN3 or AIS. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
If I told you that, now it's let me prefix this. It's really important you've got to be honest with yourself, okay? And I say this to everyone listening in. You've got a case like this. You've really got to be honest with yourself. So, Josh, my question to you is this. If the hysterectomy specimen had shown no CIN, do you think what you did doing a hysterectomy without first re-leaping her, do you think that was the appropriate thing to do for this patient?
I don't think it would have really changed the care, because if I re-excised her...
That's not my question. Do you think it was the appropriate thing to do in retrospect, given the fact that I'm telling you there was no CIN on the hysterectomy specimen? I'm really pushing your back to the wall,
yeah,
purposefully.
I still think it would be appropriate, just given the workup that I've done leading up to that point and the fact that she was anxious moving forward and wanted no residual cervix left.
Even though the guidelines said you should have done a leap first to rule out malignancy. Are you telling me that if you had the same kind of patient coming in again tomorrow, you would do the same thing?
If I was concerned with loss of follow-up and the fact...
Yes or no?
You
wouldn't?
I would in this scenario, yes. I mean, I would recommend...
Okay, how comfortable are you, A, facing that question, and how comfortable are you answering the question?
Well, I'm not too comfortable, which is why I submitted it.
Yeah, I'm making you second-guess yourself. It's terrible.
Yeah.
It's not fun, and the examiner will do this to you. And they're not being mean-spirited. They just want to see how sure, how confident you are of what you're saying. And Josh, I can tell you, you're 100% correct. And you're even more correct given the fact that there was CIN3, because even in retrospect, you were proven correct. I gave you a scenario where in retrospect, you were proven incorrect,
mm-hmm.
but your management was still the same, was still appropriate, managing her prospectively. So that's why, to all of you listening in, and Josh, you did fine, even though I tried to intimidate you, you've got to ask yourself, are you comfortable with what you've done? And even though the examiner might make you try and make you second guess yourself, if you're confident about what you've done, stand your ground. Okay? And say, yeah, I did this for the following reasons, and
mm-hmm.
be able to talk about it. And it really is a wonderful discussion. To have in the exam. And it's a discussion that sets the stage for you to really shine in the exam. And so this is good. It comes down to the fact that you don't have a choice. You have to manage this patient prospectively. And hindsight's always 20/20.
Yeah,
going forward prospectively, you did the right thing, and what and you sort of said it, and you say it verbally in the exam. The problem that I was facing was that, given the evidence that I had, I could not turn around to this patient and say, you're clear of cancer. And because of that, and the fact that there was a positive margin, I felt obligated to be able to give her that conclusion. Despite all my attempts to have her go for a re-leap or re-cone, she was adamant. She refused. I tried my hardest to convince her to do this, but she was adamant. She wanted definitive therapy, and I felt even though this was not the recommended route, I think in her case, I felt it was the most appropriate thing to do. How does that sound to you, Josh?
That sounds fantastic. Thank you, Dr.
And I'm prepared to bet you, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm prepared to bet you what I've told you how to handle this is pretty much exactly what you did in when you managed this patient. Am I correct?
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, I spoke to her for like 30 minutes in a preoperative visit, almost begging her to see oncology or begging her for a re-excision. And he's like, well, I'm going to get
a hysterectomy. Now I'm going to criticize you, okay?
Yeah.
Now I'm going to be harsh with you. Because you should have said in your defense, when I asked you to defend yourself, you should have said, you know, I even spent 30 minutes with her in the pre-operative session. I tried my utmost to get her to do X, Y, Z, but she refused. You should have, that was a good defense point to raise. And you can, not only can you say these kind of things in the exam, you must say them. It builds your points beautifully. So, I've been doing this for 27 years. Every year, candidates come up to me when I share with them how to present a case. They say, can I really say that? And the answer is inevitably, absolutely. And you should, because when you say these things, it comes across genuine and sincere, and it shows the examiner how you went to the nth degree to try and keep this patient on the right track. So you come out shining when you say that. And by not saying it, you missed an opportunity to shine. You were still 100% correct, but you missed the opportunity to shine. You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, certainly.
Excellent, excellent. So, this case is fine. You be open and honest. And that's the take-home message to everyone listening in. If you got any case that looks a little odd or may, in fact, have been managed for whatever specific reason, not totally according to standard of care practices. I can tell you, because I've been working with you folks for so long, 27 years, you folks are making good decisions for good reasons. And 99% of the time, I mean, there are a few occasions where candidates really do screw up and don't do things correctly, and that's not good. But to all intents and purposes, virtually the whole time, you folks are making good decisions for the right reasons. And so be comfortable to share it with the examiner. You don't need to be shy about a case like this. So, Josh, are you now comfortable with this case? You know how to defend it?
I believe so.
Excellent. If you have any other questions on this, then obviously feel free to get in touch with me. But it really is totally straightforward.
Yeah.
Okay. So you say what would the recommendation have been, say what you did, and explain why you differed from the recommendation, and then you're good to go. Josh, do you have any other questions on your end?
No, I think that was everything.
On this case or any other cases for that matter?
I mean, I have an OB case, but I'll give the opportunity of other people to ask questions.
I've gone through all the questions that were submitted to me, so I'm actually, this is me opening it up. If you have any other questions, this is your opportunity.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I have an OB case. So this is a patient. She's a 34-year-old G5P4 that had no prenatal care. That a resident, the patient presented in active labor, and the resident dated her by a bedside ultrasound that dated her at 31 weeks. So they initiated The doctor that was on call before me initiated magnesium betamethasone, and then I took over midway through the shift, and the patient spontaneously delivered and subsequently measured at 3,800 grams, so a term baby. And I don't know how to categorize this case, nor do I really understand how to explain this to the examiners, because I mean, obviously, essentially, I just caught the baby in a way.
Okay, so you're being very defensive, needlessly so. This is actually a very nice OB case. Now, folks, just look at the conversation that Josh and I are having. Josh feels this is an odd case, and I'm saying it's a great case. Why do I say it's a great case? Because there are some very exam-appropriate questions that can be derived from this case. And so that makes it interesting for the examiner. And it's actually a very straightforward case for you. Mm-hmm. So I don't have the list of OB categories in front of me. And I know they did make some changes this year. So I may say something which is not up to date, but please feel free to correct me if I do. I can't recall if there's a category, something to do with prenatal care or abnormal prenatal care. Is there such a thing as that or not?
There is not, no.
Not, okay. There is a category for preterm labor and PROM, yes?
There is a preterm labor category, yes.
Yeah. There's also one for abnormal fetal growth. Well, there used to be. I don't know if it still is there.
Yeah.
Is that still there?
Yeah.
Okay. So there are at least two categories that you can put in.
Okay.
And I like to be bold, I would put in the abnormal fetal growth category. And then this case becomes a discussion on just what constitutes good versus poor gestational dating criteria.
Okay.
How accurate is ultrasound when it comes to estimating fetal weight?
Okay.
Obviously, it's a discussion on preterm labor and various tocolytics that you can use.
Uh-huh.
And there's another question which it catches us by surprise. It's a very basic question. And let me throw it out to you, Josh, and see what you can do with this.
Yeah.
Why do we have prenatal care? I mean, this patient had no prenatal care. Why do we make such a big deal of prenatal care? Why do we have prenatal care?
Because dating is everything in obstetrics, and in the early.
So you're saying dating is the reason why we have prenatal care? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think that's the gestalt of this case, but I mean, we do prenatal care.
No, I'm talking in general terms, not just this case.
Oh, I mean, to screen for, to optimize maternal and fetal health.
So that's you're well on your way to the correct answer. You're not wrong. It's to optimize good maternal-fetal outcomes. But in essence, what it is more directly, it's one huge screening protocol to determine which pregnancies need extra care.
Okay.
And I think you would agree with me on that.
Yeah.
And there's one more question that they would ask you. And that is, why is a patient who's had no prenatal care intrinsically a high-risk patient? And your case is a classical example of that. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
She was subject to all the potential morbidity associated with high-dose magnesium sulfate, which is what we deal with when we're tocalizing with MAG. You know, it's not a benign drug. And in retrospect, you know, again, you didn't have the advantage of hindsight when you were managing this patient. But in retrospect, she was needlessly exposed to the morbidity of magnesium, and that's unfortunate.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Keep that in mind. And then the last thing, I just want you to be careful, and this is a general point for everyone listening in. You didn't really say this, but it might have been construed this way.
Okay.
You tangentially suggested that, indirectly, that the resident screwed up by calling her 31 weeks.
Oh, no, I didn't say the resident screwed up. I was just emphasizing that I wasn't the one that performed the ultrasound.
Yeah, but by you didn't say screw up, but by saying the resident did it, and he or she was wrong, it's an indirect slur. I would far, this is an oral exam technique issue, I would far rather you say, you know, this EFW on ultrasound was done by the resident. But I got to tell you, if I would have done it, I would have come up with probably the exact same answer, because ultrasound in late pregnancy is very inaccurate. Just the point that I want all you folks to take home with this, with respect to this, is you can be critical of a resident if things didn't go the way you would have liked, but you've got to be academically honest, and you also, and so if you would have been in the same boat, acknowledge it.
Yeah.
And even if you wouldn't have been in the same boat, you want to try your utmost to avoid throwing your residents under the bus.
Okay.
It's not very professional. That's the point.
Okay.
And you didn't throw him or her under the bus, but by mentioning it, it sort of implied, you know, this person got it wrong, and I, when I delivered, got it right. You just want to be aware of that subtlety, okay?
I guess that's something, and not throwing anyone under the bus, but in the especially like in the nature of obstetrics, where a lot of it is can be shift work sometimes, and you inherit something that maybe you wouldn't manage a certain way, that was managed a certain way. How do you make that art like for instance, there's
it's very easy. No, it's again, just be open and honest.
Yeah.
You say, you know, I came on, this patient had been evaluated as a 31-week pregnancy and managed for preterm labor. I have every reason to believe that if I or anyone else would have made that initial assessment, I would have done the same thing. Gestational dating is just not very accurate. Now, admittedly, 3.8 kilograms is a 40-week baby plus, okay?
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's 9 weeks out. A 31-week baby would weigh about, what, 1,200 grams, 1,300 grams?
Yeah.
So this baby is out by a factor of 200%.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think you need to have to be able to address, because ultrasound is accurate plus or minus 20%.
Yeah.
So I'm rechanging what I suggested earlier. I don't think it's appropriate to say that this would have happened to me as well. I would take the following tack. And again, it's really being open and honest. I would say that this patient who had no prenatal care was evaluated when she came in for a final delivery admission as being 31 weeks.
Yeah.
That would make the baby about, and this is you saying this to the examiner in the exam, that would make the baby about 1,200 grams. You can understand my surprise when I landed up after coming on call. I landed up with a baby who broke through tocolysis of 3.8 kilograms.
Mm-hmm.
Ultrasound can be accurate to plus or minus 20%.
Mm-hmm.
But this was 200%. And this is more than three or four, even five standard deviations away. This is more than an outlier. So I don't know what happened. As a consequence of this, I did bring it up at one of our meetings, and I actually think it's an appropriate thing to do, because this is so wrong that one needs to look at how did this happen. So yeah. I think I'm taking a completely different tack now because okay. I've realized now it's 200% out as opposed to 20% out. So yeah. I would say, you know, this was so wrong. We looked back in retrospect to see how this could have happened. And unfortunately, I wasn't privy to the findings of that issue. But when you get this far out, one has to assess that something is wrong. It's either the machine, it's the person, it's something's not quite right. She may have had an obese abdomen that compromised the exam. But you go through all the issues. It actually becomes even more so a discussion on ultrasound dating and its and the accuracy thereof.
Okay.
So does that make sense to you, Josh?
Yeah, that makes great sense.
And it's a great case. Just because, look, I'm changing my tack. I'm going to say the resident screwed up. Okay, but you're not going to say that in the exam. I'm saying it now to you. To be 200% out, that's crazy. So in the exam, you soften the blow. You say something was not right here. You can't be 200% out. And there was an inquiry into what really transpired. Unfortunately, I don't have the results of that. But these are the pros and cons. And so just discuss it. From an observational point of view, not from someone who's actually personally involved.
Okay.
Okay? All righty, you're good with that then, yes?
Yes, thank you so much.
All right. Folks, so look, I hope you found this helpful. An unusual set of cases, but still there was a lot of relevance to everyone listening in, so that was really good. Folks, I just got one comment. We're into the final month, only 3 weeks left or so for collecting cases. I'm going to push the issue, as I've done before, of our cases construction course. By now, I'm almost certain virtually every single one of you, because we know historically this is what happens, every single one of you has attended our cases construction course. But if you're a new attendee to our teleseminars and you haven't come to our cases construction course, it is available online, and I can't tell you how much benefit it will give to you to enable you to construct a case list that really sets you up for success. I can't emphasize enough. So if you haven't registered yet, consider doing so. And with that out the way, I will say the next teleseminar will be in 2 weeks' time on the 22nd of June, and we'll do this all over again. It was really good to have three people volunteer, and I'd ask you, please, folks, it makes a big difference when there are actual cases and actual people on the other line that we can converse with, because it just makes the whole session that much more meaningful. So I'd ask you, please, you notice I never mentioned last names. You don't have to worry about being embarrassed if I ask a question that you don't know the answer to. You remain anonymous. So please keep it up. If you've got any questions, submit them to the office, and I'll be happy to discuss them with you at the next teleseminar. So to Kathleen and Josh and Emily in absentia, thank you very much for submitting your cases. And we'll do this all again in 2 weeks' time. Thanks again, and this then concludes our teleconference. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thank you.